This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN Summer. It's Andrew West with you. If you had to name the most Catholic country in the world, not so long ago, you might have said Ireland. Around 20% of Australians actually trace their heritage back to Ireland. But since revelations emerged in the 1990s of widespread sexual abuse in the Irish Church, observant Catholics have become a small minority. Irish writer Derek Scally is the author of The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, the Church, and the End of a Special Relationship. He joined me from his new home in Berlin, and he began by recalling a visit to Ireland by Pope Francis.
It was like the end. It was like the final collapse of something, of a tree in the forest, but there was nobody really there to hear it. When his predecessor, John Paul II, came in 1979, I think every one in three Irish people saw him physically or was at a mass or an event where he was there. So in that short time, 79, 2018, the Catholic Church as an institution in Ireland effectively ceased to exist as a relevant institution, and Pope Francis was really made to feel that.
We're going to revisit the 1979 visit by Pope John Paul II later in our discussion, but it's important to point out that in 2018, this is Pope Francis, very popular in much of the Catholic and the non-Catholic world, a deeply imperfect reformer, but a reformer nonetheless, and yet the Irish were still not impressed.
Indeed, it was perhaps for me the most striking part of the visit. It showed me the level of anger was so deep, it didn't really matter. I think Jesus Christ could have appeared in Ireland during that visit and people would have just been too damaged, too angry, or in many cases, they'd actually gone beyond anger to apathy. For me, the most striking part of the Mass that I attended, his visit was the World Meeting of Families, but there was a papal Mass at the end. And in it, he sort of threw out the script because of meeting abuse survivors the evening before. And he came out with a piece of paper. It was clearly handwritten. It was clearly the Pope. It was clearly authentic. And then he actually turned the entire penitential act of the Mass. And it wasn't him encouraging people in the crowd to reflect on their sins. He flipped it onto the Catholic Church. This is highly significant. The Catholic Church begging for forgiveness using the formal act of penitence in the Mass. Somebody's asking for apology on behalf of an institution, but nobody noticed.
Well, you did notice, and it was very significant because it sort of helps set up your book, The Best Catholics in the World. Give us a raw figure because it's pretty stark. What was Catholic mass attendance in, say, 1979, and what is it now?
What's interesting is where it used to be, where it rose to, and where it is now. So before the pandemic, we were talking around 15 to 20%. Weekly mass attendance. Back in the good old days, as they would call it, I was born in 1977. So when I was a child and I was an altar boy, we're talking well over 90%. I'd say in rural Ireland, near to 100%, but with urban areas slightly more liberal, we're talking early 90s. But before the modern revolution of Irish Catholicism in 1850, back before in the early 19th century, mass attendance was about 20%. So we seem to have seen this massive spike up to near 100% of mass attendance, and then a really sharp decline back down. So there's a case to be made that Ireland hasn't lost its faith, it's just lost the recent iteration of Catholicism, of which there are many, and perhaps we may be entering into something new.
Yeah, the biggest and most obvious reason for the collapse of Catholic devotion is the sexual abuse crisis, perhaps more severe than anywhere else, including Australia, frankly, where it's been terrible. But is it the only reason, Derek? I mean, there've got to be some other cultural factors, haven't there?
Indeed. I mean, I don't need to tell listeners in Australia the damaging effect of both the sexual abuse on the survivors and their immediate families, but also the clerical cover-up. And that seems to have been the defining characteristic for most people, where they said, right, somebody who's a paedophile, as much as I struggle with it, they are a person who needs assistance. They need to be taken out of the priesthood and given treatment and kept away from children. But the people who enable them, now there's the real problem. And that is where things collapsed in Ireland. And that's where people realized they were dealing with people, they were dealing with institutions, they were dealing with power. So you had this collapse on the one hand, and on the other hand, you had in Ireland in the 90s a tremendous surge of prosperity. You saw EU funding really beginning to blossom on the landscape, and you saw education. I mean, I'm part of a generation who had free university education from the mid-90s, and a few decades before in the 60s, free secondary education. So you're slowly seeing, effectively, the Irish people being educated past the level of education of their priests. There was a time when the priest and the doctor and the lawyer and the solicitor would have been sort of the educated people in the classic rural Irish parish. But suddenly you had all these people who were far more educated. But Irish religious education and instruction really didn't keep pace. We had Irish Catholic run schools. Most of the schools were run by the Catholic Church, but they were somewhat not able to adapt to this new educated, prosperous reality. So it collapsed for all those reasons.
It's also, I'm sure, got to have something to do with both the flight and then return of a lot of Irish. I mean, as you say, in the 1990s, you had this return of an Irish diaspora, which had experienced something outside of a very cloistered Catholic world. How significant was that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the history of Irish history without immigration and emigration in and out is really unthinkable. And the prosperity that was coming in, it was companies, it was American multinationals largely, who, you know, had people like in Australia of immigrant stock, and they would be brought in to work for the large computer companies, the pharma companies. So, yeah, they were bringing in a breath of fresh air. I mean, that's what's always been. On the one hand, the emigrants who leave Ireland, they often are like the liberal, energetic ones who could change society. And the tragedy is often that they leave and they take the pressure out of the pressure cooker, and the more conservative Ireland remains. But if you flip that, if they do return, they are more free radicals. And I think we saw another wave of that in the 2000s, which, you know, really catalyzed change and modernity. So by the time Pope Francis came in 2018, I write in the book, we didn't have holy water. We had flat white coffees, and we didn't have Holy Communion. We had sourdough bread. So yes, we very much, they brought the world in a way that the Catholic Church really hadn't done, except right back at the early days in the 600s, when, you know, Catholicism was bringing the world in of education, of science, and so on. Something people forget, before it used to be an accelerator, and now it just turned into something regressive, something defensive, something effectively that had to go.
Derek, just how Catholic was Ireland until the 1990s? I mean, how pervasive was the church's, not just influence, because there's a lot of places where there's religious influence. What power did the state give the church?
I think it's fair to say the Irish Catholic Church as an institution always had as much power as the people gave it. And that is the most painful thing for people to realize in Ireland. But it's a point I gently keep making over and over and over again. And the second point is the Catholic Church as an institution was made up of people who were Irish passport holders. Now, that may seem obvious to listeners in Australia, but if you follow the debates in Ireland, you'll see a psychological trick known as othering, which is, you know, we can call it scapegoating or othering. And in my lifetime, we've gone from the Catholic Church, our priests, you know, our holy anointed or our spiritual warriors, missionaries going out to Africa and so on. It was very much ours. And then as the abuse and the other scandals emerged, we flipped it. The narrative, the public narrative flipped to them. It was very much they did terrible things to us. And I'm gently suggesting that while this reaction is completely understandable, it was always about us and the power. We gave ourselves as a Catholic Church privilege, and we put these people up onto a pedestal, the bishops and later cardinals. But there's always a psychological need. And during the Pope's visit, I met a nun. She said, we seem to be dealing with a really old anger. And I said, what anger do you mean? And she said, we put people up on a pedestal who proved unworthy of the pedestal, and we're annoyed at ourselves for doing it. Yeah. So there's huge anger at the abusers and the people who enabled abuse. But I think in Ireland, there's a deep-seated anger towards having been the type of people who needed to put people up on pedestals who then abused the trust.
Yeah. And you point out, Derek, that it was not uncommon to have photographs of leading Irish politicians right up to the 1980s, actually, kissing the hand of bishops.
This was quite a common practice everywhere in the world, so it's not that unusual. From our current perspective, it just seems ludicrous, but deference was expected and deference was given. And that is the really complicated transaction, the really complicated atmosphere for somebody of my generation to accept that deference was expected and deference was given. And one of the abuse reports, I asked the author, what for you was the most crucial part of the report? And she said, undue deference. That is where it all went wrong. Undue deference. They didn't earn that deference, but they expected it and we gave it. And that's the really painful part. When you see in hindsight where that deference led and what was possible inside that power structure, it's very difficult to accept that you were part of that power structure.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you. We're speaking today with Derek Scally, the author of the new book, The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, the Church, and the End of a Special Relationship. What about, though, the idea that the Catholic Church embodied both Irish national aspiration, but also Irish suffering? Because I'm very taken by your own account of having in your apartment in Berlin something known as the Penal Cross. What's the Penal Cross and what does that embody in your story?
So the story goes, during penal times, which was when the British government legislated against Catholicism, it was not the official religion, and anyone who was a Catholic couldn't buy land, couldn't work at the public service, and could theoretically face all sorts of other threats. Priests stalked the countryside having private masses, and they carried this cross up their sleeve. It disappeared up the sleeve easy because of the crossbar was not as wide. For me, this cross symbolizes the suffering, the real humiliations the Irish felt under English rule for centuries. But it also represents, I think, the trauma that left, but the understanding that the trauma was in many ways far worse than it actually was. When I researched this, I found out that the Irish penal era, which is drummed into Irish school children as the ultimate, sort of effectively an Irish Holocaust, it really wasn't. There was a few dozen priests were killed and the humiliations were real, but there was not blood flowing in the rivers. But it created a victim mentality, and it was the start of an Irish national narrative of suffering and salvation paired with Irish identity and Irish Catholic identity. So this is where you started to see the two sides of the coin. And for me, it was understandable to do that, but it was the beginning of lying to people and it was the beginning of manipulating people. And that, for me, is sadly, because besides all the beauty of and the achievement of Irish Catholicism, think of the Book of Kells, something like the Penal Cross is the beginning of sort of the best Catholics in the world narrative. We've suffered more than you, therefore we must be better Catholics than you. It's like spiritual nationalism. And nationalism, being proud of your country, isn't a problem, but when you start to put yourself up and put other people down, that's where you're on the slippery slope. So that's where the penal era, the suffering era, and the immediate codification of it and the coming up with a narrative afterwards in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, many people accept this as fact. It isn't, but it helped manipulate people to where the institution Catholic Church wanted them to be.
Now, I said I'd return to that very symbolic moment, 1979. Pope John Paul II visits Ireland in the very first year of his papacy, I think. This was surely a moment of the greatest triumph for the Catholic Church in Ireland. Why do you, fascinatingly, Derek, see this as the beginning of the end for the Catholic Church?
Because I put myself in the shoes of a priest looking or a bishop looking out over the crowds. We had a mass with 1 million people in a time when Ireland had a population of 3.5-4 million. So 1 million people at a mass. If I was a priest and I looked out at that crowd cheering, I would have said, I can do anything I want in this country. And sadly, people took that. And again, my book is really not having a go at the Catholic Church. It's putting it in the context and expressing great sorrow at everything that went wrong because of the beauty of the message got so perverted. But really, with the high point of the perversion, I'd say, was this mass, because the power was absolute. They literally sealed the deal. And it was from then on that you really start to see the terrible abuses happening. When Pope John Paul celebrated mass, there was a warm-up act, and of the three priests, two of them were already fathers. Again, people were quite understanding towards them afterwards when this came out, but the hypocrisy didn't escape them. The people who had father children were some of the better ones. So the Pope John Paul mass was basically, the Catholic Church felt from this point on we're untouchable, and it was the feeling of untouchable that actually caused many of the problems rather than the actual abuses themselves.
Yeah, you referred there, I think, to a bishop, a very popular bishop of Galway, who didn't get involved in any child abuse, but it was later revealed that he had a girlfriend and had fathered a child.
Indeed, and Father Michael Cleary, the other, was another very, very popular priest. They were all very popular, and the tragedy was these priests were very close to the people. They had huge charisma, and they were very much of the people. And this is, again, the narrative. It was effectively the Pope's visit was, you know, Christ's anointed coming to Ireland to tell us everything was okay. That was the level of emotional need at the time. And these priests were coming from us, from within us, but it was already, I mean, there was in some of the abuse reports, the stories of children living in accommodation run by children's homes, where most of the children went to the mass. A priest stayed home to take care of the ones who couldn't or wouldn't go, and was abusing them while the mass was going on the radio. So it was already there. There was never really a golden age of Irish Catholicism. There was always, right back to the start, the days of Patrick, there was slavery, there was abuse of power, there was avarice, and there was pursuit of wealth. So I'm just trying to put the Irish Catholic narrative back into making it life-size again, and just suggest that what we have experienced and the tremendous rise and fall was a historical period. It needed to fall, it needed to go, and maybe, just maybe, once it's been cleared, there's room for spiritual growth and personal religious belief, because at the moment, the atmosphere is so toxic that in 2018, when people went to the papal mass, they were afraid to tell their neighbours. So we've gone from a million people going to see the Pope to people afraid to admit that they've gone to see his successor.
In the time that we've got left, Derek, I want to talk about three sets of numbers. They stick with me because they're just so powerful, so tragic. One in four, 10,000, we're talking about 10,000 girls here, and 800 infant babies. First of all, explain to me the significance of the figure one in four.
One in four is the number that emerged from a survey, not just of people with a religious background, but the Irish population. And I was asking, have you been exposed to physical or sexual abuse? When you added up all of the various groups, men and women, various age groups, between one in four and one in five people in Ireland has experienced some form of abuse. It is a staggering number. It is one that most people in Ireland still fail to grasp or refuse to grasp. But it is also the name of an organization that was set up to bring this, to lobby for these people, to make this public. It is a place where people can seek counselling. It's publicly funded, but the tragedy is there's so many people seeking counselling that often they have to close the waiting list for counselling. And I think it's testimony to just the sheer violence and trauma of Ireland's past in the church and beyond the church, that there is just such an abuse legacy that we struggle to imagine. And the great tragedy, and I point out in the book, is that this abuse is continuing. It's just no longer happening in the church context. There are no children there, and there's child safety provisions, world-class provisions, but no children. It's families and it's other institutions, and it'll be interesting to see how what energy people have in shattering the taboo of abuse in the family.
Tell us also about the 10,000 women and girls who between, I think, 1922 and this really shocked me, 1996, who worked in the so-called Magdalen laundries. What was their fate? How did these girls end up in these places, and what was their fate?
These were young women whose fate, either getting pregnant or in some cases being considered too sexy, they challenged and they questioned and they were a provocation to the idealized version of Ireland that Ireland had for itself as a modest Catholic plain nation. And having an unmarried mother or having a young girl who's pregnant and no husband, you had to make that disappear, hide things. And these women were hidden. The men never had any comeuppance. The men were protected, but the women had to go. And these women were put away in institutions, often collusion between their families and the priests. And they were not collected, and they were effectively slaves for decades. Some say they got good treatment, others got terrible treatment. And that legacy is continuing to this day. The state is apologizing. I attended a reception at the president's house in Dublin, where they were told, this is our shame, this is not your shame. So that's a tremendous help for these women, that there's still many of them alive. And it is our shame as a nation.
And just remind us very briefly, but powerfully, about the terrible discovery of what was effectively a mass grave.
Yes, in the county of Galway, in Tuam, a mother and baby maternity hospital. There's a sewer under this hospital, and apparently there's hundreds of babies there. And this revelation that they hadn't been given a decent burial, that they also had to be disappeared, is still being investigated. And it was a huge source of pain. But like the others, the huge pain is to accept that we are all somewhere on this narrative. You know, between these women, these babies who are the ultimate victims and the ultimate survivors. And then on the other extreme, you have abusers and their enablers. And everyone in Ireland has to find themselves on the narrative, the sliding scale. I call it the continuum of knowing between those two. And, you know, how much did you know? How much did you want to know? The story of Catholic Ireland and what the terrible side of it is, enough people knew, enough people felt unable to intervene. And accepting that and facing that as a country is a sign of maturity and a sign that we want to grow and learn from these terrible experiences. And if we don't, our destiny is to repeat them in different guises.
On the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, speaking this week with Derek Scally. He's the author of the new book, The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, The Church, and The End of a Special Relationship. This brings us to a very powerful conclusion, and one that I think really registered with me. You now live in Germany. You make an extraordinarily persuasive parallel between Ireland of the 20th century, largely, and Germany after World War II, East Germany in particular, under the Stasi. What is the biggest parallel there?
I think the biggest parallel is Ireland is a country that is struggling to accept responsibility for its past. We would like to find somebody we can dump not only the blame and the legal guilt, but also responsibility. Germany is a country which has its terrible past, and as you point out, comparisons really are inappropriate entirely, and I don't make them in the book, but I think the legacy of the Nazi era was so vast that once they got going, they really created a German institutions and also a sense of responsibility for, you know, being German. One of the terms and conditions is you need to understand what happened, not because you're personally to blame, but you need to understand the circumstances and what was possible. This style of institution, this style of thinking has been applied to the East German past, much more recent, 30 years ago it fell. Again, accepting that this is a collective past and this only happens in a society where the society passively or actively allows it to happen. And I suggest in the book that we don't really see anything similar in Ireland yet, because we're still trying to find somebody else to pin it on. But as a society, you have to accept the good and bad of the history of your society. You cannot just cherry pick the flattering parts. And with institutions and historians and process, this is possible. If not, we just end up in a permanent Punch and Judy show.
But there's some real similarities between Catholic Ireland of the 20th century and communist era East Germany. For example, in East Germany, the children of people considered not sufficiently loyal were removed from their parents. I guess in the way that children were taken from single mothers in Ireland. If you didn't have the requisite loyalty to the state or the church, that made you a suspect figure.
Yes, in some respects, some people might be horrified to think I'm comparing Catholicism and communism, but I'm comparing closed systems, and East Germany was very much a closed system, and Ireland was a closed system. There was a small group of people at the top who believed they knew best, and they knew how to use their power, exploit people for that. So I make several comparisons, but at the end of the day, it isn't really what was at the time, it's how you deal with it at the present. I'll give you an example. The head of the body that deals with these Stasi files, the secret police files, he said he meets so many people in his work, and one woman said to him recently, "I was responsible," she said, "for forced adoptions. So people who were, let's say, opposed to the regime, their children could be taken from them. And this woman was responsible for finding them new homes with true party believers." And she told this guy, who's now the head of the custodian of these Stasi files, she said, "I believed I was doing the right thing at the time. I was convinced I was doing the right thing at the time. But now I realize the damage I was doing. And it is now my task to try and reconcile my huge ambivalence towards my past with what I know now." And I think many people in Ireland believed that this was the best. They believed these educated priests and nuns, and the anger now, weren't we very foolish to believe them, is what a woman in my old parish told me. But there was a need to accept it, and that is very complex. And the simplest way is to blame them, point the finger and bury them, lock them away the way we used to lock up single mothers. But religious cannot be locked away, and I decided to talk to them.
Just finally, Derek, you quote a very powerful Irish figure in the global Catholic Church, and that is Cardinal Paul Gallagher, and he is a senior official in the Vatican. He speaks of Ireland in a pretty clear-eyed way, it struck me, as a nation of so-called threshold Catholics. They don't reject outright the Catholic Church, but they won't fully commit. I mean, is that how you see Ireland today? Is it how you see yourself? Because you say that you write less in anger and much more in sorrow.
Yes, in the book, I would describe myself as a grappling Catholic. I certainly know what I'm not interested in believing in, and what I experienced in Ireland, while it was hugely comforting to people, the pastoral side of Irish Catholicism is extraordinary. If you've ever been to an Irish funeral, you'll know what I mean. But the other side, it was sort of anti-intellectual, anti-modernist, defensive, obviously obsessed with sex in the worst possible way. And nobody's interested in that. Like, that is literally a toxic concoction. But because it was so successful, because it was so unique, people in Ireland, many people aren't even aware that there's other options, that the Irish Catholic potion, as it were, was very much Irish, and that I live in Germany and I get a very different sort of a Lutheran brand of Catholicism in some respects, very much personal responsibility, very much thinking, very much philosophical, which personally suits me far better. So coming here in many ways saved what was left of my ragged belief, and I have somewhere to go. But for many people in Ireland, yes, I think threshold Catholic, many people are still having their children First Communion and so on, and they're clinging on to rituals, but there's no real sense of personal responsibility. So it would be nice if, as the institution dwindles and dies in its current form, that it creates space for something else, where people actually realize, okay, I was angry with the church, but now I realize I need something, a framework for my life, for my children, and if I can accept the Catholic Church or Catholic belief on my own terms, we're not going to get into trouble with each other ever again. And that could emerge. It will take some time, but somebody I met in Rome said to me, in my lifetime, we've gone from being the best Catholics in the world to being the vanguard of international secularism.
Derek Scully, his book is The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, The Church, and the End of a Special Relationship. Derek, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for this week. My thanks to Hong Jiang, Roy Huberman and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.